Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Oil from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 5th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's not a law exactly, that whole supply, demand, price thing. More like a universal truth. The less you have of something or the more demand there is for it, the more it's going to cost, and vice versa. And in practical real-life application, there is probably no better example than oil. Back in April, Saudi Arabia and its allies in OPEC Plus cut their targets for how much crude its members would pump. Today, the kingdom, basically the world's main source of ready excess oil, promised to stick with its own production cuts through the end of the year. Russia said it's going to keep production low, too. And hey, what do you know? It worked. West Texas Intermediate was up 1% or so today, around $87 a barrel. Earlier this summer, for comparison's sake, 67. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Two of the world's biggest oil producers signaling tight supply is likely to keep crude prices high for a while, says energy analyst Stephen Shork.
It's obviously having a very strong impact on prices today and could be detrimental to global economies if this price rise continues.
Whether Russia actually will keep some of its oil off the market as it faces crippling sanctions is anybody's guess, says Andrew Gross at AAA.
Russia makes announcements all the time, but do they really follow through? Yeah, because here's the one thing we know. They need the money. And how do they make their money? By selling oil and gas.
Saudi Arabia, though, has a lot more market discipline, says analyst Stephen Shork. He thinks the kingdom is hedging against a slump in global oil demand as China's growth sputters and the global economy struggles.
We're starting to see now exports, oil from Saudi Arabia going to China actually falling, shipments going to other buyers in Asia falling.
So he says the Saudis are being proactive, trying to keep global crude prices up. Meanwhile, U.S. oil producers are likely to respond in their own way, says Eric Smith at Tulane University's Energy Institute.
It will certainly encourage additional drilling.
Gas prices in the U.S. are up about 30 cents a gallon since midsummer, according to AAA, to a national average of $3.81 a gallon. Still, says Joanne Hsu, director of the University of Michigan Consumer Surveys,
people's worries over gas prices are nowhere where they were relative to, you know, those high water marks we were seeing last summer,
when the national average for a gallon of gas briefly topped $5. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was new data today about manufacturing, a slice of this economy that's been relatively constrained this year as consumers have been spending more on services than on stuff. The Commerce Department says factory orders for manufactured goods in this economy dropped 2.1% in July. That's the first decline after four straight months of gains. Orders for durable goods, big expensive stuff that's built to last, down 5% and more. Those are big numbers. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, there is a big caveat, too.
Factory order numbers are getting distorted by what is sort of the mother of all big, expensive, durable goods, commercial airplanes, says Sam Stovall, chief investment strategist at CFRA Research.
And that is Boeing, because the Boeing orders fell to only 52 planes in July from a recent nine-year high of 304. That is what really dragged it down, the overall factory order.
Aircraft orders are pretty volatile. They have long lead times and high price tags, so economists tend to put them aside when trying to gauge manufacturing activity from factory order data, says Chris Varveras, co-head of U.S. economics at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
We want to look at durable goods orders excluding transportation.
And those actually grew in July by a modest 0.5%.
So it illustrates the struggle that the manufacturing sector has faced in the past year or so. Not declining, but not really increasing very much over this period.
Another measure of manufacturing activity came out Friday, the Purchasing Managers Index. The PMI showed the industry in contraction for the 10th straight month, but it wasn't slowing any further, says Gene Goldman, CIO at Cetera Financial.
We're seeing manufacturing stabilizing at very low levels right now, and I think that's good news.
He says other industries that took a hit this year, like housing, also appear to be leveling out.
A lot of bad news we've seen in the economy is already starting to improve.
And there's a sign of strength for manufacturing on the horizon. The backlog of unfilled factory orders increased again in July, meaning future demand is already baked in. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, clearly some first day back after a long holiday weekend blahs. Huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Interest accrual for federal student loans started back up last Friday. Payments start coming due again next month after a 3.5-year pandemic pause. And the Biden administration is doing what it can to offer relief to people with outstanding federal student loan debt, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
For more than 20 years, Carol Barclay has been paying a little over $300 a month toward her student loan. She took out about $65,000 back in the 90s to get a master's degree in infant, toddler, and family development. When she was working full-time, it wasn't a big deal.
I put it on auto pay and just really didn't think about it very much.
Until recently. Barclay's 78 now. She lives in a studio apartment in Greenwich Village in New York that she bought decades ago, and she's mostly retired.
I'm only teaching one class at the community college, and then I have a minuscule pension and Social Security. So I was more concerned about the payments starting up again now than I have been about the payments in the past.
But a couple of weeks ago, she got an unexpected email.
It was so random and weird. So then I Googled around a little bit to see, is this real?
She also texted her daughter.
And she said, is it a scam?
It was not. Barclay's student loans had been forgiven in full, thanks to a one-time retroactive fix to the income-driven repayment program. IDR has been around in some form or another since the 90s, and it's intended for people who struggle to afford their monthly payment on the standard 10-year repayment plan.
The way it typically works is you make monthly payments based on your income.
Adam Minsky is a lawyer who works with student loan borrowers. He says that's one key feature of IDR. The other key?
If you haven't paid off your loans in full at the end of the 20 or 25-year term, any remaining balance is forgiven.
At least that's how it's supposed to work.
The problem is that these programs were poorly administered for a very long time. People weren't told that these programs existed.
Or how to qualify for forgiveness. So very few people did. Instead, a lot of people on IDR plans have ended up paying more than they would have on a standard plan and watched their balances grow. Now, the Department of Education is going back through every borrower's account and retroactively giving them credit for years of payments that previously didn't count and for periods their loans were in forbearance or deferment. So far, it's determined that more than 800,000 people qualify to have their loans forgiven immediately. And it's just started sending out emails and letters letting them know.
It says, congratulations, the Biden-Harris administration has forgiven your federal student loans listed below in full.
Tammy Wyatt got the letter a couple of weeks ago. She had to read it a few times before she registered what it said.
I went into shock.
Wyatt is 52 and lives in Dayton, Ohio. She had to retire from her job as a nurse in the Air Force a few years ago because of a disability. Like Carol Barclay in New York, Wyatt has also been paying her student loans since the 90s, and they've been a major source of stress. She took out about $50,000 to get her bachelor's degree in nursing.
When I got that first student loan, Bill out of nursing school, I had sticker shock. It was more than my rent.
Her rent was maybe $400 or $500 a month. Her student loans were $1,200. Wyatt was eventually able to get her monthly payment lowered to a couple hundred dollars a month, but because it was so low,
I ended up basically for 20 years just paying interest.
And not even all of it. The unpaid interest got added to the principal, so even though she was making payments every month, her balance grew.
And I just prepared myself to pay on this until I died.
Then she got the letter.
I could not believe, after all this time, all that work getting through nursing school, after 20 years of military service and 3 deployments, that it was finally forgiven.
Her balance was almost $52,000, about the same amount she borrowed more than 20 years ago. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Consumers are, as we probably say too much on this program, to be honest, the be-all and end-all of this economy. We spend, the economy's probably doing okay. We don't, it's not. Data out last week proved that point once again, the biggest increase in consumer spending the past 6 months. But why? Why do consumers keep on spending? We got Professor Adriana Sapper from Arizona State University's Carey School of Business on the phone to talk things over. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So since you're the expert in this conversation, and since consumer behavior, I guess, since the pandemic has really changed, do me a favor and like characterize how we're spending our money, would you?
This notion of revenge spending has come about. Individuals were in the pandemic felt as though, you know, there were limitations from the start. And so our spending habits were very, very much curbed. And so now the notion of coming out, being able to engage in things like fine dining, more social interactions, which are accompanied by also expenses, that has led to an increase in just spending overall.
Much as it is a dish best served cold, revenge eventually cools. Does revenge spending eventually cool? Are we going to sort of get out of this?
We would expect so. There have been some indicators, despite retail sales being high in July, and consumer confidence being high, it does seem like student loan payments will resume in October. The discount retailers are starting to see an increase in spending there, which can be an indicator that people are starting to watch their wallets again.
Right. As we watch our wallets, though, what are the lengths that we go to justify our spending? Right. I mean, because we do like to spend money in this country.
Oh, absolutely. I think you really hit the nail on the head there. A few things. First, we often categorize things as exceptional expenses, like, oh, I'm just coming out of kind of being at home for a really long time. I haven't seen these friends. I'm just starting to travel. So it feels like a one-time occasion or opportunity, but actually they're not that infrequent. Similarly, we can justify with motivated reasoning. I'm sure you've heard of this notion of girl math.
I'm sorry, girl math?
Girl math.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because that would get me in trouble. What is girl math?
I don't love the name. It was essentially it came from this kind of podcast episode about how to justify expenses. And so they were talking about, okay, there's these big expenses, maybe a Taylor Swift concert, maybe certain things for the home. Well, let's break it down by day. Let's take a video at the Taylor Swift concert. If you watch it every day, then suddenly the cost of that concert per view has gone down. So the notion of motivated reasoning there is quite potent.
Right, right. Which applies, to be clear, to men as well in this economy.
Absolutely. Justifying your expenses in creative ways in order to feel better about them and less guilty applies to everyone.
Right. Here's a justification I use all the time. You know, I had a tough day. I deserve this, you know. All right. For me, it's like a moderately expensive beer. But for some people, it's a cup of coffee or, you know, a nice blouse or whatever, right?
I mean, we spend to regulate our mood to feel better because we feel like we deserve something. You know, we put a hard day in, or even to reassert control. If I spend on this product that I feel like will kind of help me in life, then it gives me a feeling of control.
Let me ask you about external influences on consumers. And I'm thinking here specifically of social media, right? Which makes the old adage of keeping up with the Joneses, that social media takes that and puts it in your face 24 hours a day.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that is something that I think that we're all susceptible to if you are on social media. And you have kind of a dual influence because you have the highlight reels of people's travels to Europe or nights mm-hmm. out or fancy dining outings. And you couple that with these incredibly targeted ads that know exactly what you're on the market for. And at least for me, that has very much haunted me. I was on the market for a backpack, an expandable backpack this summer for travel to Europe. And I now have been targeted with every single type of expandable backpack option available. And so ultimately, I ended up getting one. But I will say that the targeted advertising made me much more acutely aware of how I'm being tracked. And that also can lead to increased spending. They know exactly what you want.
I kind of love that you, the expert, actually got bombarded and you finally relented.
Well, you know, they call it me search, right? So I must say that I am very susceptible. But I like knowing about the background to be able to potentially put in some limitations.
Yeah, got to do your research. Adriana Semper, she's a professor at the business school at Arizona State. Professor, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up.
Got to get it while the getting's good.
I mean, show me the lie, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 195 points today, almost 0.6% for the blue chips, closed at 34,641. The NASDAQ off 10, about a 10%, 14,020. The S&P 500 subtracted 18 points on the day, 0.4%, 44.96. Two companies joined the S&P 500 today, which means their shares trended higher as index funds sought to scoop them up. Airbnb gained 7.25%. Asset manager Blackstone picked up almost 3.6% today. The brands they're replacing, Newell Brands, owns a range of products from Elmer's Glue and Rubbermaid to Coleman Camping Gear. And Mr. Coffee slid almost 4.9% today. Insurer Lincoln National dropped 3.3%. Things went from bad to worse over the weekend for fans of the English soccer club Manchester United. First, they lost in stoppage. Heck of a game, though. Then the Glazer family, which owns a controlling interest in that club, just like they do with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in football, by the way. They announced the team was no longer for sale. Fans had, of course, been hoping for new ownership. The Glazers are not popular. Shares dropped 18.2% in New York. Ticker symbol, by the way, for Manchester United, Man U. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's an innocent enough question, really, but also somehow kind of complicated. What are we going to have for dinner? The answer usually includes some kind of protein, which the food industry likes to call the center of the plate. Exactly what the protein at the center of the plate is, though, changes with time and with dietary trends. The Wall Street Journal had a story today about Tyson Foods, the big poultry producer, and how it's closing some processing plants, in part because they seem to have overestimated our zeal for chicken. And also, as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, because protein fads are influenced by everything from price to habit to TikTok.
The hot protein of the moment?
People put cream cheese in everything now.
Jennifer Bartashis is a senior equity analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. She says the cream cheese trend emerged through social media. A quick scan turns up recipes for cream cheese pasta sauces, spinach turnovers, and meatball stroganoff. And Bartashis says restaurants start trends too.
Just after the height of the pandemic, we sort of saw a chicken sandwich war. And we saw chicken sandwiches at every fast food restaurant imaginable.
Chicken was also relatively inexpensive, which is why it was so attractive to restaurants. Purdue's Joseph Balakhtas says prices matter in the grocery store, too, especially if people are choosing between, say, different kinds of meat.
The relative price of pork and chicken and beef might affect what people grilled this past weekend.
But on the spot, they're not likely to swap out their meat for, say, legumes.
The price of those products relative to lentils probably didn't have much influence.
Balakhtas says a lot of food trends are driven by habit, and people need to be comfortable with how they're preparing their protein of choice.
Or I need to be in the habit of exploring and being sort of inventive, and not everybody's great at that, right?
That's where TikTok trends can inspire people to try out new ingredients. But it's not like the food industry can immediately respond to every new protein craze, because Truist Restaurants analyst Jake Bartlett points out, some foods take a while to produce, like beef.
From farm to fork, it's about, you know, 2.5 years for a cow. So it takes some time to rebuild that herd.
In case you're wondering, pork takes less time to produce. And Bloomberg's Jennifer Bartashis says she thinks the next big thing will be bacon. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Agriculture in the great state of Georgia brings to mind peanuts, probably, peaches, definitely, pecans for sure, or pecans, take your pick, or pecans, don't know, Vidalia onions as well, citrus though, not so much. That's long been Florida's domain because Georgia's always been just a little bit too cold. Until now, over the past decade, the number of citrus trees in the Peach State has gone from a relative handful to more than 500,000. As Emily Jones of WABE and Grist reports, climate change, disease, and science are all at work here.
On a punishingly hot, sunny morning, Jake Price walks through his rows of citrus trees. This small plot is part of an experiment Price is leading as a scientist with the University of Georgia.
Look how much fruit this tree has.
It's straight out of a Tropicana commercial, a lush, leafy tree laden with plump little tangos, one of the easy-to-peel varieties of citrus sold in stores as cuties.
There's probably 25 pounds per tree on these.
But over the winter, this grove was put to its first big test.
You see the big gash on the bark?
Around Christmas last year, these trees had to weather 6 days below freezing.
They had a big freeze crack on this rootstock.
It was the first bad freeze since small farms in Georgia began experimenting with citrus, starting with 10 or 15-acre plots. But those trees had yet to weather a bad winter. Farmers worried their brand-new crop was about to get destroyed. But for Price, the cold snap became part of his experiment. He's trying to identify which rootstock, the base of a citrus tree, can best stand the cold.
It's kind of a rare opportunity to get some data on which rootstocks give the best cold protection on these tangos. So got to get it while the getting's good.
Price says there are still these cold snaps, but they're less common than they used to be. Climate change is heating up winters especially fast. The average winter temperature in South Georgia has risen 6.5 degrees since 1970, according to Climate Central. That means fewer sustained freezes. So Georgia is increasingly a good place for citrus.
We have a piece of fruit that looks like it's grown in California, but tastes like it's grown in Florida, which is what everybody wants.
Justin Jones grows Satsumas and Navel oranges near Albany, Georgia. Farmers say the humidity there, like in Florida, makes for sweeter, juicier fruit. He also grows pecans and cotton and sees citrus as a chance to diversify his crops. Plus, Jones says, disease in Florida has created an opening in the citrus market.
Unfortunately, in the farming community, in the farming world, somebody has to do bad for somebody to do good.
Florida citrus is doing very bad. A disease called citrus greening has devastated the industry there. The state has less than half the citrus acres it did in the 90s because of it. The greening disease hasn't gained a foothold in Georgia, and growers are trying to keep it that way. And after Georgia's small citrus farms survived last winter, Georgia Citrus Association President Lindy Savelle says bigger farms are getting interested.
They realize, well, my gosh, if I can handle 17, 15 degrees for 4 days, that's a 30-year weather event. I think I can do this.
She says even though the freeze may mean less fruit to harvest in a few months, it was also a big test, and Georgia Citrus passed. In Valdosta, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think you can maybe put Lionel Messi up there with Beyonce and Taylor Swift as economic rainmakers. He's maybe a distant third, to be fair. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal. The day of the Argentinian soccer superstar's first game with his new team, Inter Miami, MLS season pass had more than 110,000 new signups. The day before Messi's first game, 6,143 signups. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Do with this what you will. Goldman Sachs, with a nose for the zeitgeist, was out with a new research note yesterday in which the bank said it was lowering its odds of a recession in the next 12 months from 20 to 15%. The title of the note, Soft Landing Summer. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.